The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
A lot of you are probably familiar with my bird guide, so I'll talk a little bit about that, and I'll talk about my my new guide to trees. I've been drawing birds and watching birds for most of my life. My father's an ornithologist. That probably has something to do with it, but it's something I've always really enjoyed. The excitement of bird watching, never knowing what you're going to find, and just the challenge of finding them, seeing them well, and learning about them. And I'll try to describe some of that during this this talk. This is one of my earliest drawings. It's a duck hawk, now called peregrine falcon. I did this when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And at this time, I had started out drawing, tracing pictures from books. I actually highly recommend tracing as a way to learn how to draw something. I know that art teachers might cringe, but tracing, this drawing is so complex, to try to translate something three-dimensional into a two-dimensional set of lines on a sheet of paper. There's sort of muscle memory, hand-eye coordination, and just the process of selecting the lines to put on the paper. If you can shortcut it by laying a sheet of paper over the thing that you're trying to draw and just trace the edges, it really helps. And after you've had a little practice with tracing, you can graduate to copying like I did with this. This was copied from a book. And eventually graduate to copying from real life, drawing birds in the field. I think everybody, when we're out looking at things, anything, it doesn't matter whether it's architecture or fashion or something in nature, we all respond emotionally to things that we see, and we want to remember something to kind of have a picture or some memory of it. Some people take photographs. Some people write in a journal. Most bird watchers will write down the date and location of a bird sighting on their list, and that's their souvenir. I always drew sketches, and this sketching a bird was the way for me to really get to know it. Sketching forces you to look really closely at something. You have to look at every single part and learn all the details, sort of like an interview. You're looking at the bird and you're interviewing it, saying, okay, how big is your head? How does the head connect to the neck? And you go through all this whole process of putting the picture of the bird on paper. It forces you to look at every single detail, every part of the bird, as long as the bird stays for you to look at. So I was just watching birds, and whenever I could, drawing sketches to capture information, really. It's a I should have added in my list before, photographers, diarists, artists, etc., hunters, obviously, bring home a trophy. And that instinct, I think, is not so different from what bird watchers do. So I was capturing the bird on paper, capturing the information about it, and writing these notes, doing sketches, learning as much as I could about what the birds looked like, how they behaved, their posture, shape, and lots of comparative notes of different species. All with the goal of getting to know the bird a little bit better so that the next time I saw it, I'd know it a little bit better, recognize it faster, and learn more about it. So I went to college for almost a year, and then left to go birdwatching full-time. My first full-time, my first birdwatching job after I left college was counting hawks at Cape May, New Jersey. Cape May, where this picture was taken, became my home off and on for almost 20 years. Just fantastic birdwatching there. And all the time I was working on bird sketches and watching birds, and working on just that real challenge is converting the three-dimensional moving bird into a set of two-dimensional marks on a sheet of paper. And it really, it's partly about simplifying what you see, partly about finding the right lines, finding the way to represent the motion, the shape, that will distinguish that species from other species. And when it's when you really get it simplified down to that sort of essence of the bird, it's really fun when it works, when you do a sketch and it just sort of pops out as that's what that bird looks like. And it's the result of a lot of hours of watching and mostly a lot of hours of either thinking about drawing or actually trial and error, just putting lines on paper and learning what works. This is a picture of me in the back of a friend's car. It's a very cold day, obviously, in eastern Maine, and I was sketching a hawk owl. And I'll show you that one of these sketches of this hawk owl in a minute, but I wanted to start with the sketch of the first hawk owl I ever saw. This was in upstate New York. And this hawk owl, it was about the same time in my life as the white-winged crossbill sketch I showed a minute ago. So you'll see a similar style outline. This bird I only was able to watch for a few minutes. We were on a family trip, and we made a little detour to see the hawk owl. And I did a quick sketch in the car as we were driving away, just to remember a few things, just to put things that I had noticed, things that were in my mind, I wanted to get them on paper. And one of the key things, which shows in the lower sketch here, is that you can't see a hawk owl's feet when they're sitting on a twig. The feathers of the belly completely fluff out and hang over the twig, so you can't see the feet at all. But there wasn't a lot of observation involved in this. It was just a 5 or 10 minutes looking at the bird and a quick sketch done as we drove away. 7 years later, there was another hawk owl that I saw that spent most of the winter living in a highway clover leaf in Portland, Maine. And I went up a couple of times to see that. This was one of the first sketches I did the first time I went. And it's 7 years later, so my drawing skills had improved, my general knowledge of birds and how to use a pencil on paper. And you can see in this I'm sort of struggling with finding the right lines and patterns to represent the hawk owl. I was most happy with the little sketch on the lower right, so I drew a little line around that to remind myself. But I continued sketching and watching for hours that day. By the end of the day, I was getting more comfortable. I had practiced enough to learn sort of what the essential marks are on a hawk owl. And I went back 3 days later, and I spent hours working on this one sketch. I said, I'm going to pick one profile view that I can replicate, that I can study, wait for the bird to get into that pose, and keep watching it, and try to draw every detail of the plumage. So there's a lot of time involved in this sketch and a lot of erasing. And it's not, it looks a little stiff and contrived, but it was a great learning experience just to sit for several hours and watch and try to get all these markings exactly right, and gradually figuring out how the feathers were arranged and what made a hawk owl look like a hawk owl. And after that, I did a few quick sketches, and getting much more confident and able to just quickly draw the lines and the markings that really make a hawk owl. Now, another 7 years later, up there in Pembroke, Maine, another 7 years, and that 7 years was really intensive, full-time bird watching and sketching. So I'd gotten a lot better at drawing. And this is one of the last sketches I did of that hawk owl after a couple days of watching that bird, working on a series of sketches, getting to know more about hawk owls. And really, at this point, I felt like I knew a hawk owl about as well as I could. And this actually is getting... beyond the kind of artwork that I wanted for a field guide. This is more more artistic. It's a different pose, obviously, a back view with the head turned. But most of my field sketches, I have some more. At the same time that I was learning how to draw a hawk owl, I was learning a lot of other general things, like how a bird's wing folds, how the feathers lie on the body of a bird, which is similar in all species. So every bird that I sat down and studied, like I did that hawk owl, would teach me things about all other birds. This is a more typical field sketch, where that hawk owl... I was trying to capture that individual bird in that moment, that pose, to capture the personality of that individual. Most of my field sketches are sort of a composite of many different views of a bird, trying to draw the average, which is what you're really looking for in a field guide. So I'd watch a bird like this gray flycatcher for off and on as much as I could for maybe, this might be 15 or 20 minutes of watching. Do a few quick sketches and write a lot of notes, trying to capture the proportions, the general things about the body, but not to make it specific to that individual bird, but to gray flycatcher as a species. Here's a study of two species of hummingbirds in Arizona. And this is really more what I would consider a classic field guide illustration. It's stripped down to just the essential bits of information that you'd need to identify these two species, which is mostly shape, shape and proportions. And that's really what you're... aiming for in a field guide illustration is to simplify almost to the point of sort of a subtle caricature, that you want to show the distinguishing features of that species, but leave out as much of the extraneous details as you can. So in some ways, this sketch would make a great field guide illustration for how to identify these two species of hummingbirds. You don't need to know that they're both green on the back and sort of grayish with a hint of buff underneath. This is all you need to know to identify these two species is shape and proportions. So as I worked on the bird field guide in the early years of working on the bird field guide, I was working in this sort of more artistic style, and still you can see I was putting in a lot of detail and putting in details like the droplets on the water droplets on the bird's head at the top center that is representing an individual bird at a moment in time, and this is a little bit of an extreme concern, but there is a concern that people would look at that in the field guide and think, oh, a common loon will have water droplets on its head and yellow-billed loon won't. And that's so obvious that most people wouldn't consider that, but a lot of other subtle things can creep in that would lead to false assumptions. This kind of detail, I gradually got away from that, and the field guide illustrations that actually appear in the book are quite a bit simpler. They're really simplified to just a suggestion of feathers and mostly illustrating just broad patterns and colors. And I have a close-up of one of those birds. You can see how relatively simple the painting is. And there's several reasons for that. One, that it's leaving out a lot of the unnecessary information, all the details that might distract or mislead. But also, I think it's just almost a suggestion of the bird. It leaves something for you, the viewer, to add to it. So it can match up to any, this is an eared grebe, it can match up to any eared grebe that you see, whether you see one in the rain or the sunlight in Texas or in Manitoba. Your eared grebe experience can still match up to this sort of generic eared grebe illustration. So it leaves a lot of the details out, which allows you as the viewer to fill those in. I think it also leaves you with a desire to fill in those details, that you know there's more to it. This is what you need to identify the bird, but you really want to get out in the field and see it in real life, to see something more like that hawk owl sketch where all the details are there and it's really alive and a real bird. I was subconsciously thinking of all of those things. I didn't actually consciously make all these decisions along the way, but I had a feeling that simpler was better in the field guide, and I went for this kind of illustration, also because it's much faster. So this is what the finished page in the field guide looks like. And to me, the individual illustrations are just pieces of, they're pieces that don't mean much on their own. And even this whole collection of illustrations, it starts to show the patterns of variation. You can see eared grebe on the left and horned grebe on the right, and by scanning up or down the page, you see the whole range of variation of plumages of those species. And I wanted to show those patterns, there's a rhythm, there's all these different patterns of variation that I wanted to represent in the book. But to me, the whole book is really the art project. The individual illustrations or the individual pages don't mean as much on their own as they do when they're all put together in the entire book, and then you can see not just the variation in each species, but the diversity, the whole range of variation and the patterns of variation across the whole diversity of North American birds. And so that was my real goal in the field guide, was to try to get at some of those, the bigger patterns and the real diversity of forms and colors in North American birds. Now, about 7 years ago, I decided to do a field guide to trees, and you're probably all wondering why or how I got started on that. I thought I wanted to do another big project to try to capture again some of those bigger patterns of variation. So I wanted to do a book size project and not another bird project. And I started looking around at the other topics that I could cover, and trees kept coming up as the thing that you see every day, all the time, even more than birds. You see trees. You can identify trees from a distance. There's all kinds of subtle and not so subtle clues that will allow you to identify them from naked eye, from a moving car across a field. This photograph shows a gray birch in the center with a quaking aspen on either side. And they're two trees that in the winter they're superficially similar. The bark is similar. They both have whitish, smooth bark. But the shape of the twigs and the texture of the twigs, the fineness of the twigs is very different. So just by looking at the twigs of these two species in the winter, you can identify them at a glance. And as I looked at trees more, I started to notice these kinds of things and realized that yes, quaking aspen had this in common with all the other poplars, cottonwoods, and gray birch had this twig structure in common with all the other birches. So there are those bigger patterns. Trees also, like birds, have spring colors, seasonal changes that allow you to identify them at different seasons. This is a view from a hilltop in Connecticut in late April. And the bright green trees that stand out in the center are Norway maple, which is a very distinctive tree. You can identify it from miles away just for this couple of weeks in the spring when they're flowering. They stand out. The paler green trees just behind the Norway maple are sugar maple, which are also really distinctive, flowering at the same time, and that's a pretty distinctive color. Surrounding that are a few red maples and a lot of oaks. In the foreground and background are white pines with that distinctive upswept branches. And here's another example of spring color in trees, these clues that show up just for a couple of weeks at different times of year. It's two different variations of red maple in the foreground, a bright red one on the right and a pale, sort of dull orange color. There's a lot of variation in the flower color of red maples. So those are both red maples in the foreground. The bright green tree is a quaking aspen. That's just, the leaves are just emerging. And just for this, just for a few weeks in the spring, it's very easy to distinguish quaking aspen from big tooth aspen, which is pretty difficult. You have to get close at other times of the year to see the leaf shape. But for this couple of weeks, the quaking aspens are leafing out very early with bright green leaves. The big tooth aspen will leaf out maybe 3 weeks later. And when their leaves emerge, they're covered with whitish fuzz. So they look completely different. So for just a few weeks in the spring, you can drive around the roads, and from half a mile away, you can spot all the quaking aspens, and then a couple weeks later, all the big tooth aspens in your town, which is kind of fun. These aspects of tree study, tree identification, were really reminding me a lot of bird identification. There's something to look forward to each season. There's different challenges as the trees change during the course of the year, these subtle clues that you can use just for a few weeks. And spring, summer, fall, and winter, different species have different field marks. Here's an example of a fall tree, some fall foliage, that one bright yellow tree out there is one Norway maple. It's against a backdrop of red oaks and black oaks. The tree to the right of the soccer goal that has a more pinkish color, that's a white oak. In the far background, those are red pines, but that's a... You can tell they're not white pines, but distinguishing red pine, pitch pine is difficult. But anyway, this is another example of a... you see these trees that just stick out like a sore thumb just for a couple weeks in the fall, and you can recognize them. Usually these trees that have some bright fall color much later than all of the native trees, those in native red oaks and black oaks in the background, the cultivated trees are the ones that hold their bright fall foliage longer than the natives. So usually when you see one of these trees that sticks out with bright colors, it'll be a Norway maple, Callery pear, maybe a planted sweet gum, or some cultivars of red maple that come from more southern areas where they hold their leaves longer. They'll keep their bright red leaves weeks longer than the locally grown native red maples. So there's all kinds of interesting things to look at all year. Now that I guess I've touched on it a little bit, the other thing that I'll get to that in a minute. One thing that was very different about trees compared to birds is probably pretty obvious, that they don't move. So the field work that I did, I was able to just walk out into the woods with my camera and sketch pad and take notes, take photographs, do sketches of 20 or 30 different species of trees in a few hours. Birds, it would take me days for something like that gray flycatcher sketch, or the comparison of the hummingbirds. I'd go days trying to find an opportunity to study those birds, and then finally have a chance. So I could maybe on a good day of bird work get sketches of two or three different species. With the trees, it was almost infinite. So I collected all these photographs and sketches and notes and started working on putting together the tree guide. There were a few things that were very different about the tree guide compared to the bird guide. One was one of the first things I realized is that birds are completely audiovisual creatures. They communicate with each other the same way we communicate with each other, by sight and by sound. So all of their social signals, all of their displays are things that we can see or hear and understand. But trees don't really care what other trees look like. So the appearance of trees is really sort of accidents of evolution. It's the leaf shape has evolved to fit the local climate, to give the right balance of water conservation, but sunlight gathering and wind ability to shed wind. So all these things in the trees are they've evolved to fit the local climate, but not to fit a predetermined or some selected appearance. Which means, on the one hand, a lot of trees look very similar to each other. On the other hand, a lot of trees are extremely variable. So it makes tree identification, the way we look at trees, really difficult or challenging. The other thing I had to deal with that I found was very different from the bird guide is the question of scale. in the bird guide, I was, for every species, every plumage, I painted the whole bird, and all the field marks were visible in an image of the whole bird. With trees, I couldn't paint a whole tree. The painting would have to be 10 feet tall to show enough detail to be able to show field marks on an illustration of the whole tree. So I had to select parts of the tree to show, and that was a long process of trying to decide which parts would be the most useful, what I could show most consistently across every species, what size to make each element on the page. Gradually I worked out this sort of layout of showing a few leaves, twigs, fruit, all at about the same scale. Bark, obviously, at a smaller scale. For some species, a whole tree at a much smaller scale. And a few species also twigs, or twigs with leaves and fruit, again, at a slightly smaller scale. So my goal was that the same way that you look at a whole page in the bird guide and you can see at a glance the whole range of variation of that species, that as you look at a page in this book, hopefully you'll be able to sort of look at all these parts and assemble them into an overall view of what the parts that make up that tree. This is red maple, and this is a lot of different details for this species. There's two different, often distinguished as two different subspecies with different leaf shapes. The southern one shown on the left here with less lobed leaves, and the northern one on the right. The other thing that led me to try to do a tree field guide was that looking around at other tree field guides, and I had used a lot of different field guides and quite a few tree field guides over the last 20 years. My impression of all of them was that they were really working with identification methods that had been in the bird world had been superseded 80 years ago. When Roger Peterson published his field guide to birds, it was a great leap forward. Probably because the trees don't move, it's easy to just walk up to a tree and take out your hand lens and look at the shape of the bud scales or whether there are hairs on the underside of the leaf or other details like that, and stand there while you work your way through a key to arrive at an identification. That's possible with trees. So in a way, I've sort of set up an artificial challenge of identifying trees from a distance or in a on the fly, the way we identify birds. I think that's it's a much more satisfying way of getting to know the trees. And where a key and sort of the botanical method of tree identification directs your attention to a few individual features kind of in isolation. You don't even really know at many points why the distinction is important at each fork in the key. But you eventually get to an answer. This method, more like the modern style of bird identification, you look at the whole tree from the very beginning. You look at all the parts, and you look at the page in the book, and you see all the parts of the tree. And as you, it's just a visual catalog. You're matching patterns. See something in the field and flip through the pages of the book until you find pictures that match. And in that way, I think gradually you develop a sense of what makes a maple a maple. What all the maples have in common, what all the oaks have in common, develop an understanding of not just the identification of an individual species, but how it fits in with all the other species that are related to it or not related to it. One of the other things that really struck me as I started working on the tree guide was how much trees blur the line between the natural world and the human world. And I'll get a little philosophical, but birds are, they sort of represent wilderness and freedom. They it's like they're visiting us from the wilderness, and they're they at least appear to be wild and free, completely unrestrained and unaffected by the human world. Even if we're at a sewage pond looking at a pectoral sandpiper, it still sort of carries the memory of the Arctic wilderness where it was born. So it's easy to go birdwatching and keep the human world and the natural world completely separate in your mind. But the trees that we see around us have been fundamentally altered. As you, especially in the cities, of course, in the suburbs, as you drive around Philadelphia, virtually every tree that you see has been planted and is cared for and cultivated basically as a giant garden. All the forest, every single bit of forest in eastern Pennsylvania and New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, was all cut down. Even 300 years ago, all the forests were cut here. They've been, all the forest that we see now is on land that's been cut many times. There's more actual forest habitat now than there was 100 years ago, at the expense of farmland and some other open habitats, but there's actually more forest now, and all of the forest that we see is second or third or fourth or fifth growth. Even the forests that that appear natural are still sort of peppered with exotic species, catalpas, black locust, Norway maple, species some from other parts of the U.S., some from other parts of the world, but not native technically to eastern Pennsylvania. But even though we can look at all the trees and intellectually sort of understand that they're not truly wild, that they're, it's sort of like a giant garden, it really doesn't diminish the excitement, the pleasure of being out in the forest, of seeing trees here in the city, walking around a park and looking at sweet gum and ginkgo and the other kinds of trees that are planted here. We simply accept that these trees are not completely natural, that it's not wilderness, and at the same time that sort of points to a broader definition of nature, that maybe a lot of things that we consider part of the human world have a lot of nature in them. There's a long tradition going back to Thoreau and even before of considering the natural world sort of pure and good and the human world in a very negative way. And there's a constant struggle to prevent the human world from encroaching too much on the natural world. We want to keep some places more natural keep the human world out of those places more. But the truth is that the two worlds blend completely and imperceptibly. There are gradations from a completely human world, completely civilized, to almost completely natural in some wilderness areas. But almost everything that we see every day is a mixture. And both both sides are really essential to our physical and mental health. Putting a name, when we go out with a field guide and go bird watching or tree watching and put a name on the trees or birds or whatever, we get to know them. And we, in one sense, we're stepping outside the human world and making contact with the natural world. But at the same time, maybe even more so, we're bringing those species, those birds and trees, like new friends, into our world. We wonder, you know, once you get to know them, will the sugar maple tree have really brilliant fall color this fall? The juncos are due back in a couple of weeks. Will it be a good year for siskins? All these questions, the same way we would wonder about our friends or relatives, we sort of bring those birds and trees and other things into our daily lives. And we say we connect with nature, but I think we're really more connecting with the nature that's already inside each of us, the natural rhythms and instincts that we share with every other living thing. And it's that connection and that understanding and realization of our own naturalness that I think is the real goal and the real pleasure of any kind of nature study. Thanks. I'd be happy to take questions. There's a microphone, so if anyone has a question, just raise your hand.
Yep. Hi, I just was wondering, with all of the different species that you have drawn of birds and even of trees, do you always have a living specimen to work with? Have you seen every one of those birds on your life list? And have you? And when you look at the detail of like splaying the wing feathers, I mean, have you seen decoys? Not decoys, but stuffed taxidermy birds. And like, what is your material for? I can get the sketches, but those kinds of details. Have you had that kind of an intimate relationship with every one of the birds that you've sketched?
I had seen almost all of the bird species in the bird book. There were about eight species that I had never seen when I painted the book. I've seen a few of them since, but some of them were really closely related to other species that I had seen. So it was easy to just, like for island scrub jay, I could paint a western scrub jay and just modify it a little bit to fit the field marks of island scrub jay. Others like Eurasian dotterel, which is a really distinctive plover, I'd never seen that, and that was really difficult to paint because I could find lots of reference material, the photographs and look at specimens, but you don't know when you're looking at those things what's really true. You'll look at photographs and they'll show a wide range of different postures and colors. And without any actual real-world experience, I don't know what's right, where the truth is. And I couldn't really make a composite like I tried to do with the other birds. So I did, along in the years of research for the bird guide, I had a lot of experience working in banding stations where I was able to hold birds in my hand and spread the wings and look at them and take photographs. I did a little bit with my father. I did a little bit of museum work, working with study skins. And I actually spent a lot of time in museums looking at specimens to work out a lot of the details of distinguishing subspecies and species. So all that experience, and that in-hand experience is really crucial to getting to know the birds and learning how the wing works, how the legs work. with the trees, there are a lot of trees that I have never seen in life. I didn't have time to travel around and try to see every species that's in the book. So I probably saw two-thirds or three-quarters of all the species. Most of the ones that I had never seen were, again, species that are very closely related to species that I knew well. So some of the local species of oaks or hawthorns, and for a lot of those species, all I was painting was a couple of leaves and maybe one or two examples of the fruit. So it wasn't as critical to have actual field experience with them. But I know at the same time that this whole as I learn more about trees, as I go forward, actually using this book myself and hearing from people with reviews, that there will be lots of things to change to make leaf shapes more typical or to represent things that distinguishing features that I just didn't know about or didn't show in the guide. So. Yeah.
Does this tree book, or maybe a future book for you, make any connection between the trees and the birds? Because there's substantial relationship there.
Yeah. I mentioned birds in a few places in this book. There are only a couple species of birds in North America that are really, really closely tied to certain species of trees. The red-cockaded woodpecker with longleaf pine and Kirtland's warbler with jack pine. That's really the relationship between birds and trees. Other than that, is more generic. It's there's lots of fruit-eating birds that like all of the fruit, the sort of berry-producing trees like mountain ash and crab apples and hawthorns. There's lots of seed-eating birds that like some of the seed-producing trees like ash and box elder and birches, those kinds of small seed-producing trees. Jays are close. Oh, I should mention pinyon jay with pinyon pine. That's a really tight relationship. And Clark's nutcracker with whitebark pine and limber pine. That's another close relationship. A lot of the jays are closely associated with oaks. But anyway, I kept trying to find an opportunity to put a bird into the tree book somewhere, and I never came up with a good spot. There are lots of birds and trees are completely intertwined. You can't really see one without the other. But finding a specific relationship is pretty difficult. So, yeah.
You had mentioned some of the classic identification books are out of date, in a sense, and I wonder if you could be more explicit about that.
The tree books, you mean? When I say they're there are actually a couple of tree books that were published in the early 1900s that are really one in particular called Trees in Winter. That was way ahead of its time. It was identifying winter trees by their shape, by the bark, by the structure of the twigs and the patterns of the branching twigs. And it was published in, I think, around 1910, almost 20 years before Peterson published his bird guide, but it's using a lot of the same methods. And it was written by a couple of professors from the University of Connecticut, and they talk about how they were so excited that they've been learning these things and found that they can teach this method to students. And it was so far ahead of but was ahead of the bird guides at the time. That method of looking at the whole tree and just by things you could see from 100 feet away, identifying the species. But I think it's because there was really no perceived need for a book that used that sort of method that tree books have continued to use, like the Peterson Field Guide to Trees, which is a great book, but it divides the species up first by whether the leaves are alternate or opposite. So the first thing you get is splitting everything into alternate or opposite branching, which is not really a taxonomic feature. It divides the species quickly into two groups, and it's something that's easy to determine if you can walk up to a tree and look at a twig. But it's not any more helpful than, say, dividing birds into species with forked tails and species without. That you'd end up with, you know, most of the swallows and most of the terns have forked tails, and then a few other species scattered around. So I think that's sort of it immediately puts you on the track of you have to get right up close to the tree to see whether the leaves are opposite or alternate. And it right at the start puts you on the track of not having all the related species together. And then it goes on further to divide species up by leaf shape, which is, again, since, as I said, the trees don't care what their leaves look like. there's a lot of variation in leaf shape. And all the maples do tend to have leaves the same shape, but this box elder, that's a maple. And you can identify it as a maple by all kinds of other features that it shares with maples, but it has compound leaves like an ash or some other species. So in the Peterson Guide, it ends up being grouped with the ashes, which obscures the flowers. It has a typical maple-type fruit, the paired seeds with wings, and it just once you get to know it, it just looks like a maple. And that was more what I was trying to get at with this book, and where I think the tree field guides never really got past that. It was the what in bird watching is called the museum style identification back in the late 1800s, when the method was to shoot a bird and hold it in your hand and go through a key to figure out what species it was. And it was kind of revolutionary when Ludlow Griscom and Peterson and others in the 1920s started identifying birds in the field and didn't have to shoot them. So not that there was really people aren't shooting trees or cutting down trees to identify them, but still, I think it leads to a much quicker and more complete understanding of trees if you approach the identification this way, rather than that traditional botanical way. Yeah, in the back.
Yeah. You talked about a little bit with your guide to birds, making more of a generic representation of the individual species. The fight for life and survival in an individual tree has kind of created a lot of unique proportions and branches for each tree. Was this a tree book more of a creative, artistic process for you, trying to decide how you're going to represent the tree, or how many of these individual drawings in the books are almost portraits of very specific trees that you know?
That's a good question. There are a few paintings in the book are actual paintings done in the field while I was looking at an individual tree. Most of them were done in the studio. When I started the project, I thought that I would be including a lot of images of whole trees showing the entire tree from a distance. And gradually I realized that those images just wouldn't be that useful. Because, as you said, there's so much variation in trees depending on the conditions that it's growing in, how old it is, what's happened to it during its lifetime. Even trees growing very close to each other of the same species, if their roots are tapping into different conditions, then they'll grow very differently. More and more, as I went along, I downplayed that aspect of tree identification. So I'm kind of looking more at I found that the shape, the pattern that the twigs make, like in the photograph of the birch and aspen side by side, looking at that scale, at the top of a tree, there's some pretty reliable identification clues there. But if you step back 100 feet and look at the whole tree, it's much more difficult to identify it. So binoculars are still really useful for tree identification. One of the things I noticed early on when I started looking very carefully at trees and looking at things like twigs in the crowns of the trees, this is just an example of one of the variations that I had never considered. In Concord, Massachusetts, where I live, we're about 25 miles from the coast, and the weather's pretty benign. We get some wind, but not a lot, and the trees don't have to contend with a lot of strong wind. And one day I left my house to go out to the coast on Cape Ann in Massachusetts. There was a big storm coming, and I wanted to see the storm. So I left my house in Concord, where it was a windy morning, and the trees are waving back and forth. All the twigs, the crowns are swaying and getting whipped over by the wind. And as I drove out to Cape Ann, where the wind was even stronger, the same species of trees there were standing up straight. Their twigs were just kind of vibrating a little bit and shifting slightly in this much stronger wind. And I realized then that that's another aspect of how different the whole growth form, the resources that a tree puts into its twigs depend a lot on the conditions that it experiences while it's growing. And those trees that are encountering a lot of wind actually grow much stouter, stiffer twigs than the ones that don't. And there's all kinds of other variations, much more obvious than that, so that I ended up painting these kinds of details and then the sort of slightly larger scale images of treetops and bark. In the middle.
What media did you...
yeah, what media...
Your images. Thank you.
That is a good question. I meant to talk about that. All the tree paintings are done with acrylic. I did all the bird paintings with gouache, which is opaque watercolor. But I always struggled producing green colors in gouache. The paint just doesn't produce really good, rich greens. So I decided early on that I needed to switch to, and I thought acrylics would work. So the first couple years of the tree project, I was doing research and I was playing around with acrylic paint and learning how to use it and figuring out that it did work. It was definitely the right choice. So that all these are acrylic paint. Yeah. Wait for the microphone.
I have a very loud voice. I'm sure everyone hears me. But anyway, it's obvious from the acrylic, these have quite a bit more vibrance to it, and then shading is very good. Yeah, have you ever thought about redoing some of your birds in the gouache? Because the gouache is kind of a muted medium. So
yeah.
this is really nice. Yeah. And some of your birds are nice, but this is nicer.
Well, thank you. I still think that for most birds, gouache I think is still the better medium. That I haven't tried painting birds with acrylic, so I may discover now when I get back to painting birds in acrylics that I'll like it. But I still think that for the subtleties of color and shading and the texture of feathers, the softness of feathers, that gouache has a certain quality to it that works really well. But it is definitely more muted, sort of pastel-like colors. So it may be that some species, like indigo bunting, I'd rather use acrylic. One more? Okay. Back there.
Thank you for all you shared. I was thinking about the for example, the gardens in this area. We have an 18th century one, the Bartram Gardens, a 19th century one, the Morris Arboretum, and then we have the 20th century one, the Longwood Gardens. And I was just down at the Philadelphia Navy Yard that's being retooled and all this kind of thing, and they have all these lead certified buildings and everything else like that. And I'm just wondering, what's the kind of botanical garden or the urban gardens? Do you see any, what the future, the 21st century one might look like?
That's another good question. A lot of the research for this book I did in the Arnold Arboretum in Boston and Mount Auburn Cemetery, which are both 19th century gardens. I would personally like to see more native trees, a more natural garden. There's so much now of cultivated trees. We walked around the azalea garden here at noon today, and there's sweet gum and ginkgo and a couple of European lindens and Kentucky coffee tree and trying to think what else. But a lot of species that wouldn't be growing there if it was left, or wouldn't have been there, say, 400 years ago. Even though all those trees that are there are still, they're still essentially wild, you know, they're in the wild, they're interacting with the birds and the insects and all the other things that are out there, but because they're not native species or they're not typical of this area, they don't have a whole community of insects and other things that live with them. And in a lot of cases, that's why they're chosen, because they're sort of immune to the local insects. There's been a lot of interest in what's called backyard habitat, gardening for wildlife. It has a couple of different slogans, but just the idea of turning your yard, turning a city property into good habitat for local wildlife, and that involves planting native vegetation, which will attract more insects and produce more food and be just better adapted for the local birds and animals. So I would hope that there's room for a garden like that, that would be trying to recreate the native flora instead of being a flower garden, a garden of exotic and attractive trees from around the world. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.
Thank you for coming today, and we'll be signing books upstairs. Thank you. Mm-hmm.